Leave him. That's all we can do.
No. We'll stay together. Die together if we have to, but we ain't leaving him.
Quantrill, Frank, and a handful of men had lit out to Kentucky to lay low and make plans. Jesse and Cole were down in the Nations. I'd been in charge for the past week, and we'd lost over half our squad.
That's crazy!
I gigged my horse past him and up the mud-slick trail. We'd been fighting on the run for 3 days. Parker Avery, Quiet Jack, and myself were all that remained of our old squad. We had 2 new men. One had taken a slug through his chest.
That's how it is. We're staying up here till morning.
I topped the hill and ran my new bay mare into the shelter of a pine forest. Seconds behind me, Parker and Jack came splashing in. Their coattails flared out behind them.
Jack's right!
Parker reined up beside me.
Even if he lives, he'll slow us down.
I started to swing my mare away, but Parker grabbed her bridle.
It ain't your fault, dingus. You gotta let it go.
No!
I yanked loose as Floyd Nix came up off the trail leading Kenny Elworth. He rode toward my whistle.
He's one of us. I ain't leaving him to die alone.
Wet mane clung to Kenny's face like a shroud, and his left arm hung lifeless down the horse's side, pouring out blood.
Thank God. I thought you'd left us.
I glanced at Parker and Jack in a flash of purple light. They looked away. We formed a circle under the towering pines, and Parker dragged Kenny from his saddle and over to a tree trunk. We huddled there with the wind whipping our coattails and cold rain stinging our faces. Parker cradled Kenny in his arms.
He's bleeding awful, dingus. We gotta plug him up.
Shouldering in between Jack and Floyd, I bent down next to Kenny and Parker. Kenny's face was pale and drawn. His sunken eyes flickered between this world and the next. When lightning wavered across his face, it exposed the gruesome handiwork of man against man.
Stay with us, Kenny. I'll get you through this. Just hang on.
Tearing open his coat and shirt, I ran my fingers through the dark paste until I felt the bullet hole. With each breath, I felt blood bubbling against my fingers. His chest was cold as ice. Floyd Nix tore up a wool shirt and handed me a pile of rags. I took the longest strip, rolled it into a tight point, stuck it into his chest, and twisted it deep. Kenny trembled, but soon the bubbling stopped. Floyd cut a piece off Kenny's coattail and laid it over the wound. I bound him with strips of rag as tight as I dared. I glanced over at Parker and Floyd.
He might make it. He just might.
Quiet Jack walked over to his rifle scabbard.
I'll watch the trail a while. Let me know when he dies.
Kenny Elworth was just a good-natured country boy who should have gone home when the war ended. He'd taken up with Quantrill's riders after Jayhawkers hung his paw and raped his mama to death. I'd trained him myself, and he followed me like a kid brother. As for cause and purpose, I reckon nobody had more reason to thirst for blood than Kenny. But I should have sent him home, and I didn't. Floyd Nix worked up a small fire near Kenny and Parker. Parker never let that wounded boy out of his arms. And I sat staring across the low flames most of the night, running things through my mind. Here was old Floyd Nix, a backwoods preacher pushing 50. He should have been somewhere thumping a Bible and eating free Sunday dinners instead of wading mud and fighting for a cause that was already lost. There sat Parker Avery, holding Kenny against his chest as if he were his own son, though he agreed with Jack and knew the boy wouldn't live the night. Since his brother's death, Parker had slipped deeper and deeper into the mindless warmth of alcohol. He was a gone-down drunk, lost in a sea of blood. I shivered and drew closer to the fire. I huddled near the tiny fire and stared across at Kenny for the longest time, watching his soul slip away little by little. I had some dark thoughts about living and dying that night. I knew it was God's business, but I sure questioned his bookkeeping. Near dawn, Kenny Elworth stirred a few seconds and gazed over at me.
Jess, that you?
I circled the fire and leaned down close to Kenny's face. Parker had dozed off with Kenny in his arms. Floyd leaned in with me. Jack Smith walked up behind us, cradling his rifle.
It's me, Kenny. You lay still and rest a while longer.
Did we get a bunch of them, Jess?
Yeah, we got a whole bunch. Now be still.
Reckon I'm gonna die, ain't I, Jess?
I glanced at Floyd, who reached out and put his hand on Kenny's forehead. I looked back at Quiet Jack standing behind me. He rolled his eyes and looked away. Turning back to Kenny, I placed my hand against his cold jaw. It was smooth as a baby's.
I think maybe you are, Kenny.
It don't matter none. You all will drive them Yankees back, won't you? Won't you, Jess?
We will, Kenny. You know we will.
God bless Dixie.
I watched his eyes glaze over as peace soothed his tortured brow. As I brushed his eyes closed, I remember thinking of something my pa always said when somebody died.
He's gone off to dance with the angels.
Floyd bowed his head as Parker stirred in his sleep. I began standing up slowly, taking Kenny's hand from my arm.
Should have finished him off last night. Could have been halfway to Missouri by now.
My 44 rammed into his balls as hard as I could. He hit the mud face down and rolled up like a bale of cotton. I ran out into the woods and I leaned against a pine tree, hoping the damp, cold air would cleanse me. I could not square myself to having trained that poor boy to fight and die for something I didn't believe in any more than a hog believed in Christmas. This war was not personal enough for me. I felt no sacrifice on my part. I had no right to share Kenny Elworth's last seconds of life. I was a fraud, I thought. Unworthy kin of that brave young man. I felt lower than a snake and commenced shaking deep in my chest. For a long time, nearly till daylight, I hung there against that ancient pine, and though I ought not to admit it, I wept until my tears ran dry. When I walked back to the fire that morning, Jack was hobbling around stiffly, gathering his gear. Beside him was a sickness he had spit up. Floyd and Parker were already mounted, waiting for me to join them. Kenny's body was wrapped in a gray blanket laying beneath the tree where he died. Jack limped over and struggled up the side of his horse. Seeing his difficulty, I shouldered him under the rump and pushed. When he sank in his saddle, still bowed over at the waist, I stepped back.
Jack, I didn't mean to hurt you, hitting you in the nuts the way I did.
Jack looked puzzled and shook his head. He glanced painfully at the others, then back to me. Floyd and Parker pulled down their hat brims.
You didn't mean to hurt me? Well, I'm damn glad you didn't mean to hurt me, because if you had, I guess it would have spit my balls out on the ground. You hear that? He hits a man in the rack with a 10-inch shooting iron and says he didn't mean to hurt him. I'll be damned.
I took a rising for what I said, but Jack never held a grudge over it, and he never let me live it down.
It's a pardon, boys. They ain't likely to offer it very long.
After hiding back and forth between Rock Ledge and Piney Creek for 3 weeks, we'd met up with Little Billy Clinton, Skillet Meeks, and Deke Fulton in the woods outside of Clay County. We sat around a low flame wrapped in wool blankets against the cold, foggy night, cooking shoosh on the ends of our knives.
And take it. Nobody will think less of you. But we're staying till the last dog's hung, right?
I don't know. I'm just crawling through it one day at a time. But like Jack says, do what you think is best for you. We'll never belittle you for it.
I don't trust it.
Kindness.
The firelight danced in Deke Fulton's narrowed eyes and cast an unwholesome glow on the jagged half-moon scar running down his left cheek into his scraggly beard.
They know they'll never beat us, so they gotta forgive us. Ain't that something? I'll die before I pledge honor to a Union flag.
Well, me and Skillet talked it out and we're going in. Reckon you got room for Deke here, don't you?
I glanced between Parker, Floyd, and Quiet Jack. Their eyes showed approval, but I thought about Kenny Elworth and how I should have sent him home.
Why don't you go on in, Deke? Nobody gave it more than you have.
You saying you don't want me?
No, that ain't it, Deke, and you know it.
Then what is it?
I'm getting tired of running my thumbs down dead men's eyes.
Dingus ain't always this cheerful. You just caught him on a good day.
He's off, Jack. You know why I'm saying it.
Well, then, he'll ride with you?
Deke knows he's welcome.
Jesus Christ. My woman's dead.
both my boys dead.
Above his wide grin, his eyes slanted down in pain, like a lost soul begging mercy before the throne of God.
Lord God, Dingus, what's the point?
I saw his gun slide up from his holster, but I hesitated a split second before making a move.
So long, Dingus.
Deke slipped the barrel into his mouth.
Good Lord! God!
I wiped the blood and flecks of meat from my face as I leaned over and pulled him up into my arms.
Let's move out. They heard that shot plumb into Kearney.
Damn it, Deke.
Next morning, after the ruckus, we'd found a farmhouse over in Jackson County. Seeing the house had been recently abandoned, we hid our animals in the barn and rested 3 full days thinking over our situation. Jack sat near the front window, keeping an eye on the road.
Jack, the fighting has about spun itself down, don't you reckon?
I don't know. We'll have to see what Jesse says. This is his squad, don't forget.
You're the stupidest son of a bitch.
Jack's .44 was out and pointed at me from less than 10 feet. I would have been no more startled had he actually blown a hole through me. I froze, seeing a quick streak of madness shoot across his eyes. Then he caught himself, let the barrel down, and dropped the gun in his holster. He turned back and leaned against the window frame. His hands shook like a man with a fever.
Whoa, Jack. What the hell was that?
I didn't mean to throw down on you, Jess, but don't ever call me stupid.
I won't.
I stood there watching his back, wondering if it was over. I'd hit on some deep place inside him, something that should be left alone. He studied the road a while longer, then tossed a glance over his shoulder.
Just because a man ain't real smart at some things, that don't make him stupid.
He stared back out the window like he was speaking to the road.
You can't punish a man, browbeat him, treat him like he's an animal just because he ain't fancy smart. Can you? Can you, damn it?
No, Jack, I reckon not.
I mean, not everybody can be some, you know, big-shot lawyer or doctor or something. That don't make him a dumb brute animal.
You're right, Jack.
I dragged my bindle and saddlebag across the floor toward him.
You're right. Damn it, you're right.
Just because a man...
Hold it, Jack. Hold it. Please. I was wrong saying what I said. I admit it, but, Jack, I'm too stove up to fight you. And I know better than to throw down on you, so let's not say no more, all right?
All right.
Jack looked puzzled, as if he didn't know what had just gone on. He looked at my gear on the floor, then back at me.
I'm hanging it up, Jack. I'm hanging it up right here. This war has run its course. That's all I should have said in the first place. If you need to hear from Jesse, you're hearing from him right now. He left me in charge, and I say it's over. Go on home.
I hefted my saddlebags up on the table and divested myself of my articles of war. I held the bag upside down, spilling the contents on the table. A .38 revolver, a Derringer, loose shotgun and pistol shells, a leather garrote, my Glades knife, an oak club filled with lead, and 2 burlap hoof mufflers. Limping over to my saddle, I unsnapped my sawed off and pitched it to Jack. I pulled my Colt .44 from my waist, then I had Jack run a loop of rawhide through the trigger guard, and I dropped the loop around my neck. I let the pistol hang loose down my chest in full view against the white shirt Jack had scrounged out of a closet.
What happens now?
I dragged my saddle across the floor. At the door, I stopped and took my hat off.
Like I said, Jack, go on home, or do whatever you want.
I took the gold-braided band from my hat and pitched it to Jack. It was the braiding worn by all the boys. Wearing it now would be like pinning a bullseye on my back. It was a most peculiar thing. I'd been ducking from tree to stump all them months in the middle of the night with soldiers on my neck all the time. But that day, bold as brass, I rode 2 hours through the burnt section and never come upon a soul till I crossed the Carthage town limits. All the way there, I mulled it over in my mind. The fighting was over except for rounding up the guerrilla forces. I figured wearing a decent suit, even if I did smell a skunk and bearing no more arms than any other pilgrim, I had a better than fair chance of passing for a civilian. I might be questioned, maybe even detained, but what the hell? I'd lied my way out of a hanging during the war. Surely I could work up something. Besides, there were no living witnesses to anything I'd done.
I rode right up the middle of the dirt street in Carthage and stopped at a hitching post outside a restaurant. As I swung down from my saddle and slipped my reins around the post, two soldiers took notice of me and started over from across the street. I limped into the restaurant with no plan at all except to get some hot food and coffee. I was prepared for questioning when it came, but right then, I believe I would have killed any son of a bitch who stood between me and a sit-down meal. As it was, I sat there and ordered without incident. Outside, the two troopers were gathering support. Knowing it, I took my time enjoying hot grits with flapjacks and salt bacon. I reckon they wouldn't make a move for fear of getting the other two customers killed if I was one of the boys. They were in no hurry. Hell, there was no way for me to leave except through them, anyway. The red-haired young woman who served me food came back when I was finished.
They'll be taking you as soon as you leave here.
Who? Taking me for what?
Out there. The soldiers will be waiting for you, you damn fool.
I just stared at her wide-eyed.
Look, I support what you all are doing. I can get you out of here.
Beg your pardon, ma'am? I've wronged no one. I'm just in from Nebraska territory, come to check on my family's farm over in Cass County. I'm of a religion that admonishes violence of any kind. Her gaze examined my face and the pistol hanging down my chest.
Anyway, I just want you to know, if you're one of the boys, I wish you Godspeed, and I'll help you any way I can.
I dug some money from my pocket and laid it on the table. If I was, ma'am, I would thank you wholeheartedly. Since I'm not, I thank you for the food and coffee just the same. When I stepped through the door onto the boardwalk, I raised my hands in the air before they could say a word. I was ready for it. It was just something I had to do and get it over with. For the next 6 weeks, I lay in a makeshift military jail under heavy guard. I thought that since the war was over, I'd be through with it. As it turned out, the war was not nearly through with me. Had I the slightest notion of what the future held that morning riding in, I would have lit out straight for Texas, maybe even Mexico. But I reckon not seeing the future is the very thing that turns a duck's ass into Sunday dinner. The best thing about having a full regiment of Yankees in the area was that it kept a man from being hanged without some kind of trial. Had the Kansas Free Militia been in control at the time, I would have been hanged the first day. After they jailed me for questioning, I lay on an army blanket staring at the ceiling. In a way, it was real peaceful in that jail cell. I hadn't been able to really let down my guard for so long. I was just enjoying not having to look over my shoulder every few seconds to see who wanted to kill me. Sitting up on the blanket, I prepared to answer a few questions and be on my way. Then I saw Daniel Zanone standing right outside my cell. He looked pale and drawn. He should have been dead. There was no way I could see him living through that shotgun blast. But there he was, big and bent, and from the looks of him, still smarting painfully from the run-in at Dance Mill.
That's him. That's one of the brothers.
Zanone turned to the officer next to him. He was an older feller with a pitch-black beard, silver-gray hair, and a red scar down his cheek. He walked with a cane.
Are you Jesse Woodson, James?
I stood and stared at him speechless.
You, sir, are you Jesse Woodson, James?
I spent the next week trying to convince Captain Morris Fitch, the officer with a cane, that I was not Jesse James. They were the only truthful words to come out of my mouth, and he wouldn't believe it for hell. Everything else I told him, he went right along with, and it was all a bunch of lies. I couldn't figure the man out. At our first interrogation session, he sat down and laid a battered photograph of Cousin Jesse in front of me. I was taken aback at the resemblance between us. When I rode with him and Frank, everybody remarked on it, but I never paid him much attention after that day at the well. I guess it took a picture of him sitting still without his eyes shifting about to make me aware of our similar features. Captain Fitch tapped his finger on the picture, staring me straight in the face.
Do you deny this is your photograph?
In the picture, Jesse was wearing his guerrilla braiding and soldiering clothes. His hat was cocked high, and his hand lay on a pistol in his belt. That's not me, no sir. I can see a resemblance, sure enough, but may God strike me down, that is not my photograph.
Do you know a Captain Daniel Zanone?
Yes, I do. I know him as a murdering, cowardly dog.
On May 17th last year, were you apprehended by Captain Zanone and his men while procuring animals and supplies for guerrilla forces at Wilson Morgan's farm near New Hope?
No, sir. But I was beaten and robbed, and my uncle was burned to death by Zanone and his men when we stopped to get directions in that area.
For the next hour, I told my story, some of it coming straight off the top of my head. Captain Fitch had me tell it again and again while he tried to bore holes in it. The more I told it, the better it sounded, till finally I started believing it myself. After 3 hours, I could have told it to God and never batted an eye. When Fitch left that day, I was as game as a fighting cock and felt as good as a man who had watched another man split wood all day. That night, the sergeant of the guards stuck a Kansas City newspaper through the bars. He just dropped it on the floor and walked away. I picked it up and looked at it in the thin evening light from my barred window. William Clark Quantrill had died 2 days ago in Louisville, Kentucky, from a rifle wound to his spine. According to the article, Quantrill and three of his closest squad leaders were shot down in a running battle across an open cornfield. The other three died on the spot, but Quantrill lingered on a few days and was taken to Louisville for medical attention. I had no doubt that my cousin Frank was one of the dead, and I spent a sad night thinking about it. The next morning, Captain Fitch had brought me to his office in shackles and leg irons. He was seated behind his desk and holding a quill pen when I arrived. At a smaller desk, next to Fitch's, a young corporal sat at attention with a quill pen and writing paper at hand. When I was seated, Captain Fitch started in right where he left off the day before. Except this interview seemed more formal and every word I said was written down.
For the record, state your full Christian name.
The young corporal commenced writing. Miller Crow. Captain Fitch produced a leather-bound Bible from a drawer and plopped it on his desk before me.
Mr. Miller Crow, do you swear on this Bible that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I slapped my hand down on the Bible and stared him straight.
Damn right I do.
For the next hour, we went over the same subjects as we had discussed the day before, except with no interruptions. When we finished this time, Captain Fitch and I sat stone still while the corporal finished scratching with that quill pen. When the corporal had completed the paperwork, he passed it to Fitch, who, without even looking at it, laid it on his desk in front of me. Beside it, he laid the quill pen and the dipping bottle.
Read it. If you find it correct, sign here.
He tapped a finger at the bottom of the page. I mulled over the letter a few minutes, tapping my chin with the feathered end of the quill pen. This was the biggest mess of lies I'd ever seen. But it would have to do.
What happens after I sign this?
One of two things. If you plead innocent to all charges made by Zanone, you'll be given a civilian trial by jury. If you lose, you'll more than likely hang. If you change your statement and admit to violating Order 11, you'll be brought before a military court and sentenced accordingly. If you choose to amend your statement, you may do so now.
Will I have somebody talking for me at a military trial?
You will.
And that will get me off the hook with Zanone?
No. If Zanone can make a military council believe you are Jesse Woodson James, a guerrilla with Quantrill's forces, you could still be sentenced to death. Only it would probably be by firing squad. If you'd like to think it over, you have until noon tomorrow.
Now, I don't have to think about it.
I scrawled my newly acquired name right across the bottom of that letter and slid it to Fitch.
Let's get a military council and let her rip.
Fitch glanced over the letter and put it away. He gestured for the corporal to leave the room. When the man was gone, Fitch gazed at me with a smile of restrained satisfaction.
Let's get something straight between us here and now. There's nothing you can do or say that could convince me you're not Jesse Woodson James. You will get a fair and impartial military hearing, but don't think you're deceiving me about who you are and what you've been up to.
Wait a minute. You told me I'd have somebody talking for me at the council. I want to meet that man. I want to know what kind of job he's going to do against you low-life snakes.
Mr. James, excuse me, I mean Mr. Crow, I will be your attorney. I will see to it that the truth comes out. After all, that is what you want, isn't it?
That evening, the red-haired girl from the restaurant showed up with a plate of fried chicken. I hoped her being here wasn't a bad sign, like a condemned man's last sit-down dinner. She had not been here before. When the sergeant took the plate and slipped it under the door, she stood close to the bars.
I'll just wait here for the plate.
I was surprised when the sergeant walked away and left her there. No sooner had he left than the red-haired girl raised up her dress and pulled out a pistol.
Quick, come here and take it.
I jumped over and snatched the gun through the bars. I stuck it under my shirt and down in my trousers.
Tonight, around midnight, when you hear a whistle outside your window, be ready to go.
Why are you doing this?
Never mind, just listen. When you go before that military board, Zenon has it all rigged up. They're going to see to it you either hang or go before a firing squad.
How do you know so much?
Hand me that plate.
I grabbed it off my bunk, threw the fried chicken under my blanket, and was back in one step.
You have friends here. I was trying to help you the other day, but you spun that religious story at me.
Who is helping me? She touched her finger to her lips as I heard the sergeant coming back. She shot me a quick, sincere smile.
Good luck.
It was like Zenon to rig that council. Anybody who'd burn an old man to death would do about anything. And I wasn't expecting much of a defense from Fitch, he being convinced I was Jesse James. Something told me to be ready at midnight and make my break. Whoever was helping me by sending me that gun was doing a damn sight more than anybody here was gonna do for me. Near midnight, I'd filled up on fried chicken and was waiting for a signal. But I'll be damned if I didn't start getting second thoughts. The one thing I swore back last year was that I'd kill that dog Zenon. I swore it to Cletus's spirit as I rode shackled toward Dance Mill. I thought Raymond Clare had done him in. Now that I knew he was still alive, I wanted him bad enough that I would kill him at that hearing if it meant my life. I would get Fitch at the same time, the dirty son of a bitch. He had to be in on the setup. At midnight, when I was busy picking thread out of my trousers seams, I heard it. I worked out enough thread to tie that small revolver up into my crotch. They hadn't searched me any of the times they took me to Fitch's office. I was betting they wouldn't search me tomorrow. After I heard the whistle for the third time, I'd finished up my work and lay on the steel bunk, staring up at the dark window. Whoever had come to help me had given up and left. God help me if I'd just thrown away a winning hand. The first thing I did when they seated me was to drop my hands in my lap so it wouldn't look too sudden when I went for the pistol. I was right about them not searching me. I'd pulled open a seam in the crotch of my trousers so I could jerk that pistol out quick at just the right second. I meant to pull iron as soon as I sat down, but looking around, I didn't see Zenon anywhere. Killing Fitch would be easy, but it meant nothing if I didn't get Zenon. Four Yankee officers entered single file and seated themselves at a long, polished table beneath a Union flag. No sooner had they sat down than Fitch stepped up to the table and began speaking with them very quietly. They stopped, and Fitch turned around as Zenon came through the door. Had Fitch and Zenon gotten within 10 feet of each other, I would have started spitting lead. As it was, Zenon went to a table on the other side of the room, and Fitch came over and sat beside me. It was all I could do to keep from throwing down on them right then, but I held out, knowing that soon enough they would be side by side in front of the officer's table. After the charges were read, the middle officer summoned Captain Fitch before them. He looked me in the eye as he stood up.
Watch this, Mr. James. General, sir, in all fairness to the accused, I ask that Mr. Zenon be removed from this room until identification is made by the first witness.
Zenon came out of his chair on that one. I could only figure they had that little disturbance made up between them to make it look good. A mealy-looking little captain rose from his chair beside Zenon.
There is no reason for Mr. Zenon to be removed from this part of the trial.
Before the prosecutor could say another word, Zenon was taken out into a waiting room. From another room, they brought in four hard cases near to my age, shackled and chained, same as me. I didn't see what they had to do with anything, unless Zenon and Fitch had it set up so that they were going to say they knew me. That made me boil inside. I felt my hand ease toward my crotch, but again, Zenon was out of the room. I waited while they seated two of the young fellers on my right and the others on my left. I tried to look them in the eyes, but they all ignored me.
You may now proceed to call the witness, Captain.
Prosecution calls Mr. Morgan Wilson of Cass County.
That was the man Cletus and I were to have met that day. I'd never laid eyes on him, nor he me. He came in from a side room, a rough-looking old feller with a gray-red beard. He sat down before he was told to, so he had to get back up while they swore him in.
Mr. Wilson, according to your sworn testimony, on May 17th, 1864, you had arranged with a Mr. Raymond Clare to have a team of guerrilla riders arrested at your farm in Cass County?
You could have knocked me out with a hard breath. My neck went chill plumb down to my shoulder blades. That was why Clare shot Zanone. He thought Zanone might spill it about the setup that day. I perked up now, but still kept my gun hand ready.
That's correct, sir.
Did you accompany Mr. Zanone into the woods where the second man waited?
I did, sir.
And how close were you to that person?
Near as I am to you.
So you would have no trouble identifying that person here today, is that correct?
That's correct.
Good.
Fitch turned and folded his hands behind his back.
Please point that person out for our record.
Wilson looked back and forth at me and the other men at the table. He began looking puzzled. He hesitated too long. I had my gun ready to come out if he pointed at me. I couldn't get Zanone, but I'd settle for busting a cap on Fitch and Wilson. I had my hand in my trousers and on the verge of coming out of my chair when Fitch seemed to go crazy all of a sudden.
Tell us, Mr. Wilson, isn't it true that you never laid eyes on anybody in the woods that day? Isn't it also true you have received payment from Quantrill's forces on many occasions for revealing locations of Union encampments? And tell us, Mr. Wilson, aren't you being paid to appear here today? And don't you realize what a stiff penalty perjury carries?
I can pick the man out.
Wilson pointed a shaking finger at the man two places on my right.
That's him. That's the man I saw in the woods.
Are you sure, Mr. Wilson?
Yes, I'm sure.
Fitch faced the man.
Will you stand up and identify yourself, sir?
The young man stood up from his chair, jerked his hat from his head, and stood at attention.
Sir, I am Private Matthew Vincent of the 3rd Michigan Infantry, sir.
It got stone quiet in that room for the longest time. During that quiet, I eased down into my crotch and let down the hammer on that pistol, hoping nobody would hear it in the silence. After that, it seemed Fitch had snatched Zanone and the prosecution by the short hairs. I never seen a man act that wild and not be drunk. It was as if he was going into a fist fight. When they led Wilson out, he was staring over his shoulder like he was fearing a back shot. As a sergeant came and took the shackles from the Union soldiers posing as hard cases, I instinctively held my hands out too. But he just stared at me like something you'd spit up after a bad meal. When Zanone returned and took the stand, Fitch tore through his story like a double-blade plow. Every time Zanone said something, Fitch would study that letter I signed and turn it all around on him. Everything I had said matched what Zanone said, except that I put it in a different light. Finally, the prosecutor was at a point where he wouldn't say anything. He just sat there looking stupid while Fitch took control of the room.
And isn't it also true that you ordered a poor, simple-minded, afflicted man to be burned to death over a blazing fire?
Fitch leaned in real close on that one. Zanone squirmed like a crippled rat.
I object. Mr. Zanone is not on trial.
Your objection is so noted, Captain. Captain Fitch, address your questions to the charges at hand.
Fitch nodded and continued, using my shooting Raymond Clare as proof that I was not a part of the ambushers. Otherwise, why would I do something like that? Each time Fitch asked another question, he did it in a way that left Zanone looking more and more like a liar, a coward, and finally, this being the last straw, a mind-sick pervert.
Mr. Zanone, is it true, as your own men stated to the accused, that you have on many occasions assaulted men and forced them to perform acts with you that a man would ordinarily perform with a woman?
That's hearsay!
Zanone seemed to swell up and turn redder than a stoked furnace. Just when I thought he was going to burst open...
You son of a bitch!
He came up swinging his chair like a club. As a whistle passed my head, I pounced across the table and into his chest. The two guards tried pulling me off Zanone's chest, but I had my shackle chain wrapped around his neck squeezing toward Tamara. I caught the bridge of his nose between my teeth and clamped down.
There again, gentlemen, is an example of a man defending his life under a brutal attack.
I woke in Fitch's office after the back of my head had exploded. First thing I did was reach between my legs for the pistol, but it was gone.
Looking for this?
I saw the pistol dangling from Fitch's hand as he stood over me.
It fell out and slid across the floor while you were choking Zanone. Nobody saw it but me.
I sat up on the divan and it felt like drums were beating inside my head. Fitch walked over to a cabinet and poured whiskey in a water glass.
You took a hard lick on the head.
He brought the whiskey to me and I took a long swallow. Only then did I realize my shackles were gone. Noticing my surprise, Fitch sat down in a chair in front of me.
That's right, Mr. James. You're a free man. For now, anyway.
My name is not James. What do you mean for now? Did we win or not?
Oh, yes. We won. Of course, you nearly killed Daniel Zanone on the courtroom floor, but overall it went smooth enough.
Well, I meant to kill him, and I will first chance I get.
Is that what the gun was for?
Yeah, that and other things, if it hadn't gone right.
Fitch nodded and pitched me the gun.
Take some advice.
Probably not, but you're going to give it to me anyway.
Fitch took the empty glass from my hand.
The war is over. Quantrill's dead. Most of the others are either dead or on the run. It's time for a young man like yourself to go on to something else. Let the old wounds heal. The prosecutor never saw your picture. I acquired it on my own. As far as anybody knows, you are Miller Crow, not Jesse Woodson James. Even if you had admitted your real name, there are no charges against you anyway. From here, you get a chance to start anew. I'd like to see you take it.
We both stood up, and he walked over and took my Colt 44 Navy from his desk drawer. The cord was still tied to it. He handed it to me butt first and then took a folded paper from his tunic.
These are travel papers. You'll have a hard time moving about without them for a while now that they're mopping up rebels all around. These say you've been investigated and found to have no charges against you. They've been signed by the general and myself as well.
I don't know what to say.
He shrugged and put out his hand.
Nothing to say. Your horse is at the livery stable at the end of town. I can't keep Zanone from coming at you, but I don't think you mind that too much.
I turned and reached for the door, but before leaving, I turned around, still holding the doorknob.
Damn it, Captain. I thought you was a no-good son of a bitch. That's why I had that gun. I figured you for another Zanone. Now, I've got to know why. Why did you help me? You knew I would have killed you without batting an eye, didn't you?
It needed doing, that's all.
My expression told him that wasn't good enough. He managed a tired smile. The flesh along his scar turned chalk white. It must have hurt him to smile.
I had a son. He was just a boy, really. Not much older than you. The war took him.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm not asking for sympathy. I'm simply telling. My son was your enemy, but hurting you won't bring him back. Now that it's over, what have we really done except kill off our children and cut scars in ourselves that will take 100 years to heal? I came down here to fight for a just cause, not so dogs like Zanone can reap their personal vengeance. I think you're Jesse Woodson, James, and I think you've done everything Zanone accused you of. But that's in the past. From now on, you're Miller Crow. Turn Miller Crow into a name you can be proud of.
I stood there nodding my head. I only agreed with him out of courtesy for saving my life. His words gave me no explanation for his helping me the way he did. I was a free man, nearly 19. I had $7, a fine shooting iron, two, in fact, counting the one the red-haired girl had given me, a fine riding mare, and an open road in any direction. All I had to do was kill Daniel Zanone, and I could light out of there owning the world and owning it nothing.
My intention was to stay in the woods close to town. I wanted to get a fix on Zanone's comings and goings and figure how to best blow his brains out. I wasn't about to be caught out on the street by any of his men if I could help it. Still, before I left town, I thought it only fitting to stop and say thanks to that red-haired girl for her offer of help. I stopped at the livery stable, picked up my mare, and led her over to the restaurant. The girl looked scared when I first walked in. These were dangerous times for folks in that area. I figured turning down her help might have made her wonder just who I was and what I was up to. Even with the war over, you could get into more trouble in 2 minutes than you would get out of in 100 years. She acted nervous when she served me coffee and shied away from me till the other customers left. When the place was empty except for her and me, she eased over my table.
What happened last night? Don't you know the risk I took giving you that gun? My friends ain't taken to trust me for a long time because of you.
I'm sorry for that. I come to thank you, you and your friends. As it turned out, I took a gamble and I won.
Well, you're alive, that's the main thing.
I laid money down for the coffee, and I stood up to leave.
What about Zanone? He'll still be out to get you, you know.
Then he better get me quick, because I'm heading for Illinois come morning.
Oh, you're leaving?
Planned on it. I reckon there's no reason for me staying here, is there?
I've got a room upstairs here. I live by myself. Had a man, but he got killed over near Shadyville fighting hawkers.
I'm sorry to hear it. I'm on my own, too. I ain't had much time in one place. Maybe I could stay another day or so.
Meet me tomorrow night. Yes, meet me out at the mill north of town.
Well, how about tonight? How about right now?
No! Tomorrow night, and I'll put on my good dress, and you bring me flowers. It don't matter what kind, just flowers.
That afternoon, I drew camp 20 yards off the road, built a fire, tied my mare to a tree, and slept like a dead man for more than 3 hours. I went to sleep thinking about the red-haired girl, and I woke up thinking about her. Since I didn't know her name, I lay there staring up through the pines, imagining what it might be. Being young and easily stirred by the pictures in my mind, I tried to imagine a lot of things about her, but mostly, I tried to imagine her name. Near dark, I pulled some dried shank from my saddlebags. It looked so old I feared eating it, but did so anyway. Afterward, I struck out walking, leading my mare across a rise in search of wildflowers. I just wanted to find them tonight. Tomorrow, I'd come back and pick them. I was still thinking about that girl as I neared the top of the rise and heard voices from the valley on the other side. Being used to prowling around unseen, I eased up and peered down at a small farmhouse 50 yards below. In the fading daylight, I saw two men pitching camp in the front yard. On the porch, there was a man dressed in a flannel nightshirt and wearing a bandage across the bridge of his swollen nose.
I'll be damned. Zanone, what have I done to deserve such luck as this?
My good fortune excited me so much, I had to ease the mare back into the woods and calm down. Figuring quickly, I checked my .44 and tried to remember the layout of the place before darkness set in. I wrapped my reins loosely around a scrub hickory for a quick ride out. I belly crawled 10 yards back to the top of that rise. By now, it was dark, except for a dim circle of light around the campfire where the two men lay wrapped in blankets. I watched a lamplight trim down next to nothing in a window, and the shadow of a nightshirt moved down out of sight. It would be just like Zanone to make his men sleep on the ground while he rolled himself up indoors. Not wanting to miss another chance of killing that snake, I crawled inch by inch, gorilla style, down into the valley and around to the rear of the house. I forced myself to go slowly and stay clear-headed. I had him. Quiet as a spirit, I eased the horses out of the corral and silently shooed them away. With my .44 drawn, I crept up against the back of that house and leaned there a long time, trying to soak up any sound from inside. I slipped through the back door and moved around the kitchen close to the wall so as not to make too much sound. I inched down a short hallway through the musty smell of old wallpaper, my pistol at shoulder level and cocked. Stopping at the end of the hall, I looked down at the flickering glow seeping beneath the bedroom door. I stood long enough to brace myself for the ruckus that would come from the front yard once I popped that .44. And I squeezed the latch and shouldered the door just enough to make sure it wasn't locked. Sleep tight in hell. With one long step, I was at the foot of the bed and I snapped the .44 out at arm's length. Spinning around, I caught a glimpse of Zanone hurling himself through a closed window, naked as shame. Just as he started going through the window, I fired at his naked white ass. Now bullets spit back through the window. I was ducking and firing back straight through the thin wall. I had to get out quick before they had time to start thinking clearly. I caught them asleep and had the upper hand, but not for long. By now, I figured one of them would be thinking enough to go around back and close my only way out. But I stopped long enough to whip the blanket from the bed. I had to know. A woman lay there on her side like she was sleeping through the hail of gunfire. Above her ear, blood poured in a widening trickle down across her face. Her body was relaxed, snuggled up like a child, naked. She looked the way I had imagined she would look all that afternoon. I can't tell exactly what happened after that. I must have run like hell, firing and ducking out through the back and up into the woods. The truth is, I felt like I just walked out in kind of a daze, pointing and firing, but not caring whether I hit anything or not. Nor do I remember caring if I was hit. I caught a graze across my right shoulder, but I didn't even check to see how bad it was. Next thing I can clearly remember, I was punching that mare out across the flatland and feeling a cold breeze pinching my face. Daylight the next morning, I stepped down from my saddle beside a shallow stream. Taking off my coat and shirt, I lay at the edge of the stream, cupping water in my hand and pouring it on my wounded shoulder. Only then did I probe around to see what shape I was in. The graze clipped me deep, right at the collarbone, deep enough to expose white bone. Other than that, and bleeding like a stuck hog, I'd be all right, physically, in a few days. As far as what happened last night, that would require a much longer healing. I wandered around the woods and flatland for 2 days, hollow-eyed and dark-minded. I didn't eat, didn't want to, couldn't sleep. Hell, I couldn't close my eyes without seeing that poor red-haired girl dead with blood filling her ear. I'd killed her for no reason except the blindness of my vengeance. That poor girl lay dead after trying to help me. It cut me deep. Finally, to save my sanity, I made myself think about her setting me up. I felt guilty as a dog for letting it come to my mind, as if she was sitting somewhere watching me and being ashamed of me for thinking that way. I got down from the mare and let the reins fall to the ground so she could go or stay unfettered. Walking to a low rise overlooking a stretch of wild grass, I sat down and stared out for the longest time, feeling empty as a hollow log. I opened the chamber on the small revolver the girl gave me and let 4 bullets fall to the ground. I closed the chamber with 2 bullets inside. I watched the wind bend lazy circles in the tall grass. There was only one way I could settle up. If she set me up with that gun to get me killed, I'd know in a second. If she gave it to me to save my life, I knew what I had to do. I pointed the gun straight out across the wild grass and pulled the trigger. I sat there a while, examining the pistol, then tossed it away from me. Had that first bullet fired, I would have put the second one through my forehead. I'm sure of it. But someone had filed the firing pin down just enough to where it fell short of striking the cartridge. I felt better now, but not much. For the next few days, I drifted between Carthage and Roscoe, staying out of sight in the brush and woodlands. Killing that girl had knocked my spirit for a loop. I still had every intention of killing Zanone, but for now, I decided that was one pot I best let simmer. Holding tight rein on my $7, I tripped the back door to a general store in Roscoe, took no more than I needed to stake me and the mare, and drifted up to Springfield with no more direction than a blind rooster. I quartered in a boarding house under the name Miller Crow and went about finding work. Easy as it would have been to hook up with some of the hard cases that roamed the area, to my own credit, I have to say, I was putting forth an effort at going straight. Though I have never been a big drinker, I hung around the local bars and gambling parlors partly out of restlessness and partly to keep an ear out for job prospects. My comings and goings were looked at by others just in terms of what I was, a young man trying to carve something out for himself. Staying at the boarding house during that same time was James Butler Hickok, later to be known as Wild Bill. Not a friendly man, Hickok exchanged greetings at the dinner table only in reply. Not being much of a talker myself, we had little to do with one another, either at the house or in the parlors where he gambled most evenings. I spent a lot of time studying the game from my spot at the bar 10 feet away. One night, when his game wasn't going as well as he would have liked, he excused himself for a minute and came over to me.
Why don't you just find something else to stare at for a while?
I'm only watching a game. I mean no offense to anyone. He stared at me a second through narrowed lids, and I wasn't sure if he was going to stir a ruckus or what. I stood firm and stared right back. I knew nothing of his growing reputation as a pistol man, but it would have made no difference. I'd done nothing to be called on, and wasn't about to step back from this long-necked buzzard. Whether he decided I was just a dumb young buck, or whether he might have realized he was out of line for no reason, I don't know. Whatever his reason, he finally nodded his head and went back to the table. To keep from fanning anything further, I soon drifted down the bar to watch a game that seemed a little friendlier.
Don't you touch it!
A few minutes later, all heads turned toward Hickok as he and another player came half out of their chairs.
You'll get it back when I get my money, not a damn minute before.
Hickok stomped across the room and threw his cards out the window, then headed for the door. He stopped and turned around, opening his coat to show a pistol butt.
Don't you wear my watch. If you wear my watch tomorrow, I'll shoot you down like a dog.
He backed out the door and left. The next morning, as I stepped out the door of the boarding house, I looked and saw Hickok standing mid-square looking at a group of men 60 feet away.
Tut!
The group parted, and Dave Tut, the man from last night's argument, stood facing Hickok with the gold watch chain looped at his vest. Straight across from me on the other side of Hickok, I saw four men who spent a lot of time with Tut at the old Southern Hotel. They stepped into a line 2 feet apart. I didn't know if Hickok had seen them or not, but there was no doubt in my mind as to their intentions. Tut pulled the watch from his vest pocket, turned it about, then smiled and put it away. It was his way of answering the invitation, I reckon. He took a step forward, maybe expecting Hickok to do the same. Hickok jerked out a .44 and put a bullet through Tut's heart on the upswing. Hickok stood holding the smoking gun in Tut's direction. On the other side of him, I saw four men ready to throw down. I pulled open my shirt and snatched my pistol.
Hickok!
Hickok swung the barrel toward me and saw my hand on my pistol. In that split second before he pulled the trigger, I nodded past him and he swung facing the four men. Two were already coming out of their holsters, but they froze under the sight of Hickok's .44. Facing them, he backed over almost beside me. All I was doing was protecting my own interest. Now I seemed to be involved.
All of you lay them shooting irons down, or more men will die here.
Hickok glanced at me from the corner of his eye. He seemed puzzled, almost offended that I'd warned him. By the time two constables arrived, the men had eased their guns from their holsters and laid them on the ground. I was still beside Hickok, grateful it was winding down.
What's going on here?
One of the constables pointed a sawed-off shotgun at me and Hickok. The other constable ran to where Tut lay on the ground.
He's a goner.
You're under arrest.
No, I ain't. It's a fair shooting.
Hickok was still holding the .44 and had hovered near the constable's chest.
You'll still have to go to trial.
I understand.
Hickok slid the .44 into his holster.
You just let me know when.
He just turned and walked away, leaving both constables standing there slack-jawed. That afternoon, I was sitting at an empty card table in the old Southern Hotel. It was slow that day, and I was waiting to meet a freight line owner about a job. Hickok came in and walked over to my table. He didn't mention the shooting right away. Looking down at me, he tugged at his mustache and studied my face.
You remind me of somebody, but I can't recall who.
I'm Miller Crow. I'm not from around here.
Well, now, what you did out there today, why'd you do that?
I felt like I should. Why are you asking?
I ain't beholden to nobody.
And you're not beholden to me. Where I stood, if they'd thrown down on you, it would have been my ass. I acted in my own interest.
That's how you call it?
That's how I call it. I saw a trace of a smile move at the corner of his mouth. He nodded his head and pulled out a chair. He dropped a deck of cards on the table and spread them into a fan.
Mr. Crow, do you mind if I teach you a couple of things?
For the next 6 or 8 weeks, I teamstered freight between Springfield and Roscoe, sometimes doubling my wages by playing poker there at the Roscoe house. They weren't the class of players that I was used to back in Springfield. At the old Southern Hotel, I didn't fare nearly as well, but what I learned from Hickok and the others stayed with me, and I got to where I could hold my own with the best of them. It was understood that I wouldn't play in a game Hickok was in at the time. Since he'd taught me a lot of inside moves, I thought it only fair.
How long will a young man like yourself be satisfied with teamster wages?
I was raised staring at a mule's ass from behind a plow. I could teamster till I die old age. It wouldn't bother me a bit.
You fought that war without a uniform, didn't you?
I knew some guerrilla soldiers along the border. You'll never hear them admit to anything. A teamster freight for $1 a day, Mr. Hickok. Any more questions? One night, when I was just back from Roscoe, I dropped my wagon at the freight station and rode my mare over to the old Southern.
Jess.
The voice came from the alley beside the hotel. It had been a while since anybody called me by my real name, so I tensed up and stepped toward the sound, my hand on my .44. There were two men on horseback sitting just outside the glow of the street lamp.
Jess, it's me, Jack Smith.
Recognizing his voice, I stepped into the alley close enough to get a better look. It was Quiet Jack, and a thin young fella with black hair hanging to his shoulders. Since I didn't recognize him, I kept an eye on him as I spoke to Jack. My name's Miller Crow, Jack, don't you remember?
Yeah, I meant to say Miller Crow. Anyway, Crow, this here is Dave Mather. We've come a long way to see you.
I nodded at Mather. He was young as I was. His jawline was set hard beneath a drooping black mustache. His eyes seemed on the verge of a deep sleep. He returned my nod, and his lazy eyes never left me as I spoke to Jack.
Didn't expect to see you again, Jack. How you making out?
Neither better nor worse. I brought you some bad news from downriver. Your cousin Jesse has been shot.
Damn it! How bad?
It's bad. Expect he's dead by now. If he ain't far from it.
Well, how about Frank? I reckon he went down with Quantrill, didn't he?
I ain't heard, but I figured you'd want to know about Jesse.
Well, I appreciate you telling me, but how'd you know to find me?
Mysterious Dave knew where to find you, but that's a whole other thing. I think Ma Samuel would want you around.
I didn't even stop to get my day's pay from the freight company or my belongings from the boarding house. I remember as we rode past the front door of the old Southern, Hickok stepped out on the boardwalk and watched us leave town. Near the end of the street, I looked back over my shoulder and he was still standing there, silhouetted in the golden light that spilled from the open door. After we struck a fire and settled in that first night, I wrapped up in a blanket I got from Jack and propped up on one elbow just as they were going to sleep. Mather lay wrapped in a blanket with his head on his saddle and his hat over the side of his face.
Dave, how'd you know where to find me?
An old boy named Zanone back in Carthage is real interested in having you killed. He paid me $50 to track you down and do it for him.
Huh.
Jack sat straight up on his blanket, his eyes wide in surprise.
It's the first I've heard of it, I swear.
I nodded at Jack, letting him know I believed him, but I had my eyes on Mather all the while. I readied my pistol for a quick move.
So Zanone knows where I am?
I never went back and told him anything. Came out here looking for you a few weeks back. Didn't know if I was looking for Miller Crow or Jesse James, but I searched you out just to see if I could.
Now that you found me?
If I had wanted to kill you, I could have done it back in Springfield.
Why didn't you?
A couple of reasons, I reckon. First of all, I didn't think much of that man, being foolish enough to pay me in advance. Other thing was, I figured anybody with more than one name was more my kind of people than Zanon. Besides, by the time I found you, I'd already spent the money. It felt like I was working for free.
I thought about it a while. What Mather said made sense to me. Why would he want to throw down on me and take a chance on getting shot for money that was already gone? He had to know Jack would side with me. Strange as it might sound, I decided Mysterious Dave Mather was not then, nor ever would be, a threat to me. I felt we were both of the same cut. I'm going to sleep now, Dave. I let the hammer down on my .44 as easy as I could. Still, I heard it uncock, and I knew they heard it, too.
I'm glad to hear it.
A second later, I heard the same sound from his blanket.